The final case for oral argument this morning is Paul Kinsman as the Secretary of Revenue in the State of South Dakota Appellants versus Metropolitan Life Insurance Company and others, appellees. For the appellant, we have Mr. Timothy Gebhardt, an attorney from Sioux Falls. And for the appellees, we have Mr. Ronald Schmidt, an attorney from Rapid City. You may proceed, Mr. Gebhardt, and you have 20 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, Mr. Schmidt. I am appearing today on behalf of the appellants, which are essentially the state of South Dakota, in a case in which I have no hesitancy telling the court raises serious questions about the legislature's ability to levy taxes. This case is relatively straightforward. It's whether the statutes that tax insurance premiums in South Dakota violate the Equal Protection Clause. For purposes of analysis, there's two important time periods here. There is prior to 1982, and there is 1982 on. And I want to address them separately because there is significant differences in those time periods.
Can you tell me, first of all, why we would be deciding the constitutionality of a statute that's been repealed for two decades?
That is an excellent question, and is something we have raised in our brief. The pre-1982 statutes were repealed in 1982. MetLife filed a claim administratively for refunds under those statutes, but they were never pursued. There was a stay. This lawsuit then was brought, challenging them in 2004, and that is an issue that we've raised in our brief, that there is no rational basis or reason for this court to go back and say, yeah, 35 years ago, a statute that was repealed 25 years ago is unconstitutional. And that's one of our arguments with respect to the pre-1982 statute.
What did MetLife do to preserve their right to challenge the constitutionality of this old statute?
As I indicated, there were administrative appeals, or there were administrative claims filed back in, I believe, 1981, covering the period from 1970 to 1981. An administrative hearing was held. Those claims were denied. One, on the grounds that they were that the statutes were not unconstitutional. Number two, that MetLife had not met certain statutory prerequisites to make that claim. For purposes of this, for the trial in front of Judge Steele, though, those issues were set aside. So, I mean, to a certain extent, I think Mr. Schmidt would contend that for me to stand up there here and say these are barred based under the prior administrative decision would be beyond the scope of the
statute. You stipulated that the trial court could decide the constitutionality of this statute. But are there some judicial doctrines that would preclude us, or at least would it be advisory to us that we ought not to be trying to decide the constitutionality of statutes that have long since been repealed?
Exactly, Your Honor. In the case that we cited, at least one case in the brief that deals with kind of a mootness issue, that once a statute's been repealed, you don't go back and address it. And we were taken to task in the post-trial briefs when I raised the point that there was a basis other than constitutionality under which the administrative decisions were ruled, and if that decision is proper, the fundamental rule is this court doesn't reach constitutional issues unless and until it has to. Again, though, with in light of the stipulation that Mr. Schmidt and I entered into, we did agree that the constitutional issue could be tried, but we reserved our defenses with respect to latches, waiver and estoppel, and the like.
But those things would be decided only if we said it was unconstitutional. Then you'd go back to the trial court and start those issues.
Exactly.
So those administrative claims are still alive, at least, how do you want to say it? They're not on their face concluded, I guess.
That is correct. They were consolidated with this matter over the objection of the state.
But there were two reasons, the administrative, or there was more than just the constitutionality that the administrative proceedings ruled on that barred them from claiming them.
Correct. One was that MetLife had not complied with, and I'm going from recollection here, it does appear in the record, I believe it's Exhibit 13, but that they had not complied with the provisions of 1055, which...
But normally, we'd rule on that first before we'd ever get to the constitutionality.
That is true, Your Honor.
So how are we going to do that when we don't have that part of us before us?
That is a good procedural question, to which my only response at this point is, as someone has indicated, you don't reach that issue because the statutes aren't unconstitutional. We don't need to go back and fight that battle because we believe that under the rational basis test that applies to these statutes, they are constitutional and that Judge Steele erred in holding them unconstitutional. And that kind of what we've been talking about kind of reflects on the standard that this court has to apply. All presumptions are in favor of constitutionality, and MetLife has to establish beyond a reasonable doubt that they are unconstitutional. And there is heightened attention, or perhaps more mindfulness, of this standard when we're talking about a legislature's taxing power under the concept of separation of powers. But I do want to get back to the different forms of the statutes. Prior to 1982, the statute imposed different, 1044-2 imposed different rates on domestic and foreign insurers. 1044-4 allowed a foreign insurer to obtain a credit against their tax if they had a regional home office in the state. The 1982 legislature amended 1044-2 so that the tax rate was 2.5% for both foreign and domestic insurers. It also changed the tax credit so that domestic insurers would also be eligible for the credit. The equal protection analysis, or the entire basis of equal protection under the state's jurisprudence or the jurisprudence of the U.S. Supreme Court, base or rests on one fundamental principle, that there's arbitrary classification. If you look at SDCL 1044-2, as it is in effect today, and has been since 1982, it says there is hereby levied a tax on domestic insurers of 2.5% of insurance premiums, on foreign insurers of 2.5% of insurance premiums. There is no arbitrary classification. The two classes, domestic and foreign, are common to insurance regulation. They are not being treated differently. Yet Judge Steele held that SDCL 1044-2 is unconstitutional under equal protection. And that's why I say this raises a serious question about the legislature's ability to impose taxes in this state. If levying equal taxes on taxpayers is unconstitutional, then evidently most of our taxes are unconstitutional.
Well, but he did it because of the credit, not because of the imposition statute.
But that is not what the order says. The order of judgment simply says 1044-2 and 1044-4 through 6 are unconstitutional from and after 1970. And you've kind of touched on a point that I think is important here, is that Judge Steele, for one reason or another, overlooked the doctrine of separability, which we mentioned in our brief. If you have a statutory scheme, and part of it can be held constitutional, and it's apparent the legislature would have intended it to remain in effect, and the other part might be unconstitutional, which we don't believe is the case here, but 1044-2 clearly is constitutional in its current form. If 1044-6 has constitutional, 1044-4, excuse me, has constitutional questions, that doesn't mean 1044-2 is unconstitutional. 1044-2 can stand on its own and does stand on its own as a fair and equal tax measure. When we get to the tax credit, again, we have to realize that what this is doing is not distinguishing on domestic carriers and foreign insurers, is what type of office do they have in the state of South Dakota. We don't care if you're a domestic. We don't care if you're a foreign. If you have a principal or a regional home office, you are eligible for the credit. And analyzing this under equal protection, that classification, you have to look at what are the purposes the legislature may have had. And number two, is it rational for the legislature to have believed it could have achieved those purposes through that classification? The issue isn't whether did they achieve it, would they achieve it, would we have drawn a better plan. The issue is whether it was reasonable for the legislature to believe that it could have accomplished the purposes. We've laid out the purposes. There were, I believe, 16 specific ones. We broke them down into four general ones. Generation of tax revenue, clearly a legitimate government purpose. Promoting economic development, surely a legitimate government purpose. Achieving fair application of the tax laws, and facilitating and enabling regulation of insurance companies. Those all are legitimate government interests. So the question is, could the legislature reasonably have believed that this tax credit may have accomplished those goals? And I believe the evidence is fairly clear that a legislator could have.
But you can't accomplish those goals through discrimination. That's what I think that's what the Supreme Court is saying, isn't it? And the question here is as to the statutes that are in existence, is it discriminatory to say that that a domestic insurance company gets the credit if they have a principal office when it's kind of a fiction because they wouldn't be a domestic insurance company if they didn't have a principal office here, and the distinction between the foreign corporations that have to have a principal office or a regional office. There's the real, that's the rub of the case.
That is part of the rub. But the case, the Ward case, which is the one that says that you can't have these discriminatory rates, says you cannot discriminate on basis of residence. We are not, the state is not discriminating on the basis of residence. It's the type of office. Granted, a domestic will have a principal office in South Dakota. Nothing precludes a foreign insurer from establishing a regional home office in the state. It's a matter of their own business decision. In fact, MetLife has never even tried. They've never tried to set up a regional home office and say, but we can't get the credit. Well, we're providing an incentive for you to come to South Dakota, establish jobs, invest in property, invest in our state, and for that you may see a reward or a reduction in your taxes. And when we talk about, well, the domestic, they have a principal office, they're going to get it. I invite the court to look at Exhibit 14 from the trial. Granted, they are eligible for the credit. They don't automatically get it. They must apply for it. There are at least 10, if not a dozen, instances shown in Exhibit 14 where a domestic insurer was taxed at 2.5%, the identical tax rate that MetLife paid. You will also probably hear that the 1982 amendments were just a way for the legislature to protect the home team, stick it to the foreigners by saying, well, we'll put this credit in here, and then the rate for the domestics automatically becomes 0.75%, which it was before. Again, if you look at Exhibit 14, I didn't count the number, but I would say the vast majority of domestic carriers paid in excess of 0.75% during the time period covered by that exhibit. There is no doubt that for the majority of carriers, the 1982 amendments raised taxes on domestic insurers. But in so doing, it gave the same opportunity to foreigners that they had had since the inception of the statutes. And it's for that reason we don't think that there is unlawful discrimination here. The structure of whether or not you have an office in South Dakota meets the purposes that have been set forth. And I guess one of the themes that ran through the trial, and I think, although I can't tell for sure, none of us can, something the legislature clearly was cognizant of, given some of the material that was evidently presented to it, was if you have a domestic insurer, they have an investment in property in South Dakota, they're paying property taxes, they have employees who are spending money, they're paying sales tax, they're providing services, or they're buying services from in-state providers, and I seem to recall hearing somewhere in economics long ago that a dollar spent turns over three times in the community. Here with the foreign insurers, if they do not have a regional home office in South Dakota, we're not seeing that investment. We're seeing perhaps the premium coming out and going to an office in New York or Chicago or wherever, and the money may be turning over there, but the legislature is sitting here saying, look, we've got domestic carriers and we've got foreign or regional home offices for foreign insurers who are investing in this state. And we think we need to recognize the contribution they already make in terms of property taxes and other taxes that their employees pay. I think a perfect example of this, and it came up during the trial, is you look at Midland National Life. Midland is not a South Dakota domestic insurer. It's a foreign insurer with a regional home office. What is Midland National Life doing? It's building a newer and larger building in Sioux Falls, using contractors, supplies, whatever. That is exactly the type of thing the legislature was trying to encourage. Is it reasonable for a legislature to believe that that may have resulted? We believe it certainly is. No one can guarantee that it would have, but that isn't the test under the rational basis standard.
If we go back and look at the old 70s statute, then even if you had a regional office in South Dakota, you still didn't pay the same. If you were a foreign corporation, you still paid more premium tax than if you were domestic. Isn't that right?
I don't believe so. My math is horrible, but my understanding is that the depending on the amount of property taxes and the like, the credit could get you down to a level equivalent to a domestic insurer. And that's what distinguishes it from the earlier cases such as Ward, where they never could. And in fact, what Ward dictated is you have to buy specific assets in the state and had one other requirement to get the credit. All South Dakota has said is put a regional home office here. It's your business decision. We don't care what you invest in or where you build it, as long as you meet these standards. One other thing I want to touch on with respect to this rational basis test. So I've indicated the bottom line, and as this court has indicated, the test is whether it is reasonable that a legislator might have thought this would accomplish these purposes. When you go through the trial transcript in this case and read the testimony of Dr. Skipper, MetLife's expert, there's one thing that hopefully will jump out at you. With respect to accomplishing purposes, he repeatedly says, well, there's more direct ways to do it. Oh, there's less restrictive means by which this could be done. That isn't the test we hold our legislators to. When they're sitting in committee rooms and the chambers upstairs, they can't draft legislation with perfection, and we can't expect them to. In this case, they did what they thought was their best approach. Whether I could have done it better, whether another legislative committee at another time could have done it better, is not the issue. The question is it at least debatable that a reasonable legislator would have thought this would have accomplished those goals? We submit that when all of the evidence is taken into consideration, there is no doubt that that is at least debatable. The fact of the matter is the current version of SDCL 1044-2 simply absolutely does not violate equal protection in any way. If there is a potential problem, it's with the credit statute, but as we've indicated, we believe that that also meets the rational basis test. And even if we set aside, should MetLife be able to go back and challenge statutes repealed 25 years ago, when you look at those statutes, it is apparent that what the legislature is trying to accomplish is to get regional home offices in South Dakota, and this was an at least debatable method of doing it. For that reason, we request that the court reverse the judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Schmidt, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Mr. Chief Justice, Justices, thank you. I'd first of all like to address the standard of review. Counsel mentioned that Judge Steele overlooked the separability argument, and I'll state as fact it was never presented to Judge Steele. And the precedent of this court is that the court can make its own determination to that effect. Secondly, the state has not addressed SDCL 15652A, which is gives effect to the trial court's findings of fact. And I would like to say that the state has not challenged a single finding of fact of the trial court. The state is arguing that the trial court didn't properly apply the law to those findings, but the record will show that the trial court actually adopted and applied the law proposed and propounded by the state. Now, I understand this court does not have to give deference to the conclusions of law of the trial court and will make its own decisions. But my point is that the facts are uncontested. There's no dispute of fact. And we believe that the trial court did, in fact, properly apply the law. Now, I would like to address this pre-procedural point that Justice Hornkamp mentioned as follows. Bear with me a second. First of all, the parties stipulated and the trial court entered an order that the trial court would declare or would determine the constitutionality of SDCL sections 1044-2 and 1044-4 and 6.
I understand that, but counsel, you know, we're not oracles. I mean, there's an old judicial doctrine that says that even if the lawyers agree that the court can decide something, the court, by its own power, can say, this is not a justiciable question for us. This is a 25-year-old statute that's been gone a long time. Why should we be deciding it now?
Well, I think the court has to reach that decision based on the facts. And the court will notice back in 1982 that these parties appealed from the administrative final decision of Director Lessem. And that appeal was subject to an indefinite stay order. In 1982, these parties filed a separate declaratory judgment action, and we're talking now that 1981, and that case was subject to an indefinite stay order. The record will show in 1993...
Does that include both the constitutionality issue and the other issue that the administrative proceedings ruled on?
All of the other... it's not before this court, but the record is here. And the court will note that all of these other arguments on administrative law, on latches, on estoppel, on statutes of limitation, were all ruled on by Judge Gores not only once, and it's in evidence, it's in the record in the first omnibus order, and the state renewed those motions, and Judge Gores reaffirmed his earlier ruling. So all those issues have been decided, and they've not been appealed from in this phase of the lawsuit because of the stipulation of the parties. And so, just from a procedural point of view, Your Honor, and in 1993, the legislature, if I might.
So did Judge Gore's rule in your favor?
Yes.
Okay. On the administrative procedure part of it, too?
Yes. And in 1993, the legislature, and the language is codified in 1055A-2, states, for claims correctly filed prior to July 1, 1993, the director shall send by certified mail to each insurer a summary of the amount shown on file. And this would relate to the fact that the legislature was aware of the lawsuits, and that's kind of what led to the 82 amendments. So the legislature actually acknowledges that these claims are accumulating. And the session law is in the annotation to that specific language. So, and they continued to accumulate until 2002, when the state for the first time denied any claims that had been filed and were accumulating over the years, which is what precipitated this lawsuit, Your Honor. So there was, the parties were abiding by the stipulation and the continued indefinite stay orders up to the point of starting this lawsuit. And those actions were consolidated by motion and order of the court. The pre-82 litigation was all consolidated in here. And then the parties stipulated that the constitutionality of those statutes from 70 through the current date would be decided by Judge Steele. And he abided by the stipulation and so held. I think that I would like to point specifically to finding finding number 29 of Judge Steele. And it says, and if I might, thank you, Your Honor, it says, and I quote, the evidence shows that the purpose of HB 1312, which is 1982, was to continue to promote and protect the domestic insurance industry and give it a competitive advantage. Now, the key fact I'd like to point out to the court is that just prior to the 1982 amendments, the rate on foreign companies was 2.5% and on domestic companies was 0.75%. After the 1982 amendments, the rate continued to be allegedly 2.5% on everybody, but with the credits, which could not exceed 70% of the tax, 30% of 2.5 is 0.75. So the actual effective rate from 1982 through today on domestic companies was identical to the 0.75 rate in effect just prior to the 82 amendments, which led Judge Steele to say that the 82 amendments were simply a continuation of the pre-existing discrimination. And I believe that's critical. Now, on, I would like to specifically address the separability argument. And the only purpose of the separability argument is to deny a remedy to these plaintiffs. And I believe that under the rule of this court, that all statutes, to glean the intent of the legislature, you have to read all the statutes as a whole, together with all related enactments. And to sever or bifurcate the credits from the tax statute does a disservice to that rule. You have to read. In fact, the party stipulated that the entire scheme, and the state in its brief acknowledges that there was a scheme of credits that actually result in the effective rate of the tax. So you can't isolate the credits from the tax rate statute. You have to look at them as a whole to see what's the net effect. The net effect was to continue the identical discriminatory rate that existed prior to 82. Bethlehem Steel, which is cited in the brief, states that you have to look at the overall, you have to construe these statutes together, you have to look at the actual operation and effect of the statutory scheme to determine intent and meaning. And here you can't just isolate and read the credits separate and apart from the tax statute. There, it's one scheme, and it results in the identical prejudicial results. Additionally, and this is extremely important, the domestic companies get the credits solely because of residency. Solely and simply because of their residency. And let's talk about reason to believe. The statutes on their face show that the domestic companies get the credits. Now let's talk about the proffered purposes. The domestic companies do not have to do one thing, zero, zilch, to attain or do anything towards the achievement of those any of those purposes.
Apparently,
and
they do
the
have
credit.
To apply, though. They do have to apply for the credit.
No, what the, if you look at the form that was cited, that's simply the tax return. So on the tax return, they cite the tax, and then they deduct the credits. And as a domestic company, you just automatically deduct the credits. And there's no evidence that any domestic company, why would they not get the credits? But they don't have to do a single activity to attempt to accomplish any of those purposes. They just automatically get it. A foreign company, on the other hand, to get the credits has to go to the burden of carrying out a part of its administrative parts of its business, move them here to South Dakota. Dr. Skipper pointed the lack of economy. It isn't a business judgment. But because of the market here and because of the cost of doing that, it's disrupting. It doesn't make economic sense. But once they're here with an RHO, they had to serve three or more states and then two or more states till 2004, while a domestic company doesn't have to serve any other state. It's discriminatory in that fact in and of itself. So the domestic company has to not do any activity. The foreign company is forced to come here and establish at great cost, and for no business sense, an RHO and forced to serve all these other states. Now, in 2004, as Mr. Gebhardt said, the legislature amended the statute to say that to get the credits, you have to comply with 58593, I believe it is, which says that you have to have your principal place of business in South Dakota. So it's our position that from 2004 through today, you actually can only get the credits if you read that statute literally and on its face, it's clear and unambiguous. The only way a foreign company could get it would be to move its principal place of business to South Dakota, which is even more onerous and doesn't make sense. So the mootness issue, again, as I have stated, from a mootness point of view, the authority, state's authority, says if the amendment or the new statute acts in the same fundamental way as the pre-existing statute, the case isn't moot. The court is not going to be deceived by a statute, a fiction, a cosmetic change, that end, it makes no end result. Again, 0.75 prior to 82, 0.75 with the credits after 82. It was simply a sleight of hand cosmetic change, same result. The legislative record establishes that. If I might remember. As I mentioned, Judge Steele found the actual purpose of the 82 amendments to simply continue the arbitrary and discriminatory classification that existed prior to 82. We believe that the amendments are pretextual, as decided by practically identical purposes set forth before this court in American Bankers case. There is no rational relationship or nexus between any purpose and any activity by any domestic company or foreign company to meet the goals assigned by the state to these proffered purposes. Why would the legislature believe that any of these purposes would be met when, in fact, the domestic company doesn't have to do anything to meet them?
Well, they're
it's discriminatory.
They're physically present. They have people working here, paying taxes, generating economic activity.
But, Your Honor, that's the point. They're getting a credit for what they'd be doing anyway.
What's the difference?
They would be doing those things anyway. So, in fact, they can diminish. They could outsource all of their employment or their claims, a domestic company could, and still get the credit. It's just nonsensical.
Well, we've given residents of this state breaks. I mean, look at a fishing and hunting license, out of state versus in state. What's the justification for that?
I don't have any, quite frankly. I understand the political and pragmatic and possibly, but I think that's a distinguishable situation. Here you're talking about an entire industry and forcing the industry to incur substantial expense in order to get a credit, which probably wouldn't be offset by the tax reduction, quite frankly, as Dr. Skipper testified. Again, I wanted to reemphasize that inseparability was not brought to Judge Steele's attention, and it was not preserved for this court. It goes strictly to remedy by the stipulation, which reserved the sole jurisdiction of Judge Steele and this court to the constitutionality, and the remedy, as indicated clearly in Bethlehem Steel case. You look at the operation and effect of the overall statutory scheme to determine if it's arbitrary and discriminatory, which we assert and believe Judge Steele properly found and concluded under the facts. Under disbursements, there was some issue made by Westlaw about Westlaw. And this court has held legal fees are not recoverable under the disbursement statute, but I want to point out that all the Westlaw charges that are in the disbursements affidavit were simply for printing the cases out. There's no element of disbursements for fees, strictly printing.
So the
printing is allowable disbursement.
The research time is not in?
No.
Oh, okay.
Not at all.
How would that be different than having books? You just read them from a book. You wouldn't charge that cost of the book, would you?
Well, I don't think it's any different than printing a brief or printing other. Printing is specifically allowed as a disbursement.
You could read it online. You could read it off the. You wouldn't have to print it out, right? If it's a case.
I guess in my practice, I print them out and have them in the file, but. Other than that, Your Honor, Mr. Chief Justice, we appreciate the time.
Okay. Thank you. No one is chastised for quitting early.
Thank you.
Mr. Gebhardt, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. I want to address a couple things up front. Separability.
Let me ask one thing first before you get started. What about 2004? The 2004 change to one state, is the question on discrimination a little bit different before 2004, when you had to have more than one state
involved? I don't believe so. And
why not?
I may be speculating on what the legislature has in mind, but we've got to realize that when the three or more started, it was back in 1970. The two, and then it later became two or more. I think what it's the legislature doing is recognizing changes and consolidation, for lack of a better term, in the insurance industry. I think it is probably simply a reaction to modern times, and that you may not have anymore a regional home office that you're going to set up to service three states. You may set one up that is just going to service one due to economies of scale or whatever. But that is my speculation. The mere fact that it is two or more states as opposed to one or more states really makes not a great deal of difference because the key is having an office here with property, employees, and the like. Whether I don't think whether that employee serves or employees are working on Iowa or Iowa and South Dakota is what the legislature is concerned about.
But it did make it more difficult for the out-of-staters until 2004.
More difficult in the sense that they would have had to consider two states in their business judgment as opposed to one state, but the bottom line is it remains a business judgment. They don't have to come. And as you indicated, the domestics are here, and they'd be doing it anyway, yes, but they're doing it here. That's the key. They're doing it here.
About Mr. Schmidt's comment, you could have basically a closet for home office and outsource everything?
I don't know that you could have a closet under the statutes because you'd have to maintain all your books and records and the like there. And again, it goes back to the legislature has not held to perfection in designing this statute. Could they reasonably have believed that placing a regional home office here would have produced the type of investment in the state and its people that are beneficial to it? And I think the answer to that is yes. I want to get to a couple of the points made in Mr. Schmidt's argument about separability. One, it's got nothing to do with remedy, absolutely nothing to do with remedy. What it says is if you're looking at a statutory scheme and one part can be held constitutional and another part may not be, you can hold the one part constitutional without violating any doctrines whatsoever. In fact, you are encouraged to do so. And I also take exception to the fact it was never raised before. Let me read paragraph 15 of the objections to MetLife's findings of fact, conclusions of law, and proposed order. The order that proposed order that in effect became the order in this case, saying 1044-2 was unconstitutional since 1970. We objected on the basis, quote, it is over-inclusive, and that it does not differentiate between and among the statutes set forth therein, 1044-2, 1044-4, and their content at various times during the period, and as such seeks to invalidate statutes that are facially and de facto constitutional as a matter of law. That is exactly the situation with 1044-2 in its present form. If you apply equal protection analysis to it, it is facially and de facto constitutional. Moreover, Judge Steele was well aware through the pretrial briefs, the trial, and the post-trial briefs about the differences in the statutes pre and post-1982. I mean, tons of time was spent exploring the 1982 amendments and how 1044-2 became an equalized rate. With respect to Justice Meyer-Henry's question about the ruling, Judge Gore's at the time ruling against us, that is completely untrue. We filed two motions based upon the Dan Nelson case saying the court did not have jurisdiction because it was seeking damages. The MetLife was seeking damages. That is what those were motions to dismiss. That and nothing else. The second omnibus order that Mr. Schmidt refers to states, with respect to the motions made by the motions, defendant's renewed motion to dismiss is denied. That's all it was. We moved to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. There was no substantive ruling on what the administrative agency ruled when it heard the case. And to clarify the record, and this is in one of the exhibits at trial, the administrative finding by the then director of the Division of Insurance, finding the conclusions of law, the petitioner's claims for refund of taxes paid in South Dakota for the years 1970 through 1980 inclusive are barred by its failure to comply with the requirements of SDCL 1027-2. Paragraph 5, that petitioner's claims for refund of taxes paid prior to March 19-1981 is barred by its failure to comply with SDCL Chapter 1055. Judge Gores never ruled on those. He simply consolidated these cases with this action over our objection, and Judge Steele never ruled on those. We raised it. The state objected.
Yes, but your stipulation seems to bring it before us anyway. We're kind of stuck with it. Isn't that right?
Yes and no. Yes, because that is what we agreed to. No, because I agree with you, Your Honor, that you're not bound by some stipulation that we may have entered into. If this court doesn't believe it's a justiciable issue or it doesn't have jurisdiction, particularly subject matter jurisdiction, it can do that in the first instance.
The stipulation or the agreement to put these appeal on indefinite hold, was that a court-approved stipulation, or is that just simply an agreement between counsel?
I would defer to Mr. Schmidt on that. My recollection is it was court-approved. I think it was signed by then-Judge Miller. That is my recollection. But
as Chief Justice, you mean?
No, as Sixth Circuit.
Okay.
Or whatever circuit it may have been.
All right.
At the time. I guess as I stand here, there's one phrase that really has stuck out in my mind since the trial in this case. Bob Baldwin, who's here today, was MetLife's in-house counsel for taxes for years and years and kind of led this fight. In discussing retaliatory tax provisions, he described premium taxes imposed by one state on another state's carrier and vice versa as the same evil. And I grant that on April 15, I tend to think taxes are pretty evil, and on April 30th, when I send in my property tax, I tend to think they're evil. But it strikes me that evil is also what the Equal Protection Clause is about. It was intended to root out discrimination, illicit and illegitimate discrimination. So what's the evil, if there's evil here? It's that MetLife says it can't get the tax credit that it's never attempted to get. There's nothing evil about 1044-2 levying a premium tax on all insurers doing business in the state of South Dakota. To hold that a statute that says that and nothing more is unconstitutional and violates equal protection is to deprive the legislature of its power and duty to levy taxes and watch out for the fiscal stability of the state. If there's an evil, and again, we don't believe there is, it may be in the credit structure. The credit in 1044-4 can be easily, shouldn't be, but it could easily be struck down without ever touching 1044-2, and at a minimum, that is what this court should do. But when you get right down to quote-unquote evil, we've laid out that the legislature didn't enact this for some evil purposes. It wasn't stick it to the foreign carriers. If it had been stick it to the foreign carriers, why would they have given them a credit to begin with? They would have just said domestic carriers get the credit. The simple fact is the legislature reasonably believed that it could invest or bring investment in South Dakota assets by its tax structure and premiums. And we believe that it is constitutional, and this court should and must reverse the judgment below. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Orr. The court will be in recess.